Welcome to ESIP's Global Economy Podcast. My name is Fredrik Eriksson, and today I'm joined by Christopher Fjellner. Christopher Fjellner is a member of the European Parliament and has, for the last 15 years, been sitting in the International Trade Committee. In that post, he has been responsible for steering European trade legislation through Parliament, and he has been known for doing so with strong expertise and support for an outward and free trade-oriented Europe. He is leaving the European Parliament after this election, and I wanted to take this opportunity to talk to Christopher about his view of EU trade policy, where it stands right now, and how it has evolved over the years. Christopher, welcome to ESIP's Global Economy Podcast.
Thank you. Very nice to take part.
So we are going to talk about European trade policy primarily. Perhaps we're going to touch on global developments in the cosmos of trade as well. But I wanted to start with a question to you about the current state of play of EU trade policy. I mean, this is something you have been very close to for almost 15 years now. And there is a debate out there right now where you have different viewpoints. One viewpoint is basically that Europe now, in this age of Donald Trump and protectionism coming from other central trade powers in the world, the EU has become sort of the shining light, the entity that tries to keep the world inside the World Trade Organization and that wants to be a progressive voice for more free trade in the world. There's a different view out there which says that, well, perhaps some of these problems that have tainted other countries may also have an inflicting damage upon EU trade policy, and Europe may not be that shining light as it often wants to present itself. So I wanted to start off asking you, Christopher, how do you view this particular debate? What's your take on EU trade policy as it stands today?
As so often, both of those descriptions are to some extent true at the same time. Because, of course, it would be a lie to claim that the European Union hasn't stood fast at a time when a lot of others have resorted to protectionism compared to others, that we, in a world that has embarked on more protectionism, Europe has kept its free trade agenda pretty clear. But the main discussion and the main conversation I hear in Brussels is rather a more self-sufficient one, claiming that it's not only, we're not only holding our ground, we're progressing free trade and we're better than ever. And that's something that I'd like to question, because I think a lot of the successes that one undisputedly have to attribute to the European Union at present time is more, I think, a consequence of the shortcomings of others. Take, for example, the biggest trade agreement that we've concluded, maybe at least during my 15 years, the free trade agreement between EU and Japan. It wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for the fact that the US withdrew from TPP. And you can take a lot of the other successes that the European Commission and trade policy prominent persons in Brussels would use as examples of EU success. Like the free trade agreement with Mexico, for example. That wouldn't have happened, at least not in that time period or with such a good result from the European side, if it wasn't for the fact that the US threatened to withdraw from NAFTA. So I think a lot of the things that has happened and is being hailed as big successes for the European Union lately is more due to shortcomings of others rather than our own achievements. And secondly, if you look closer and really study how good are really these trade deals, I would say that they are substandard. They're not modern enough. They don't respond to the demands of today's world. They're definitely not future-proof. Take, for example, the free trade agreement with Japan. The fact that we don't have a chapter on digital services in that agreement, which is due to EU policy, it's not the Japanese that's been the troublemakers in that part, is of course a good reason to question how big a success the trade agreement with Japan is. I think it's a tough call between if the glass is half full or half empty, but it's a conversation in Brussels. There's a lot of people that actually call it to be more full than it is.
So Christopher, how would you look at the trend in EU trade policy? You spoke about the glass being perhaps half empty or half full, it's difficult to say. But if you look at the trend over the last couple of years, are Europe becoming more offensive and more ambitious in its trade policy? Or has it become more on the defense?
If I would draw a line from where I started 15 years ago, there's been a tremendous change of EU trade policy, and I think for the better, because when I started, EU trade policy was, we didn't do bilaterals. We were just sitting watching, hoping to revive the dough around and debating whether corps were moving or whether it was completely dead. But with the Global Europe agenda that, if I remember correctly, was launched by Peter Mandelson, we actually acknowledge the fact that EU trade policy has to serve not only development purposes or other, it has an impact and importance when it comes to fostering competitiveness and creating new business opportunity for EU enterprise. And that was a big change, and that's probably the biggest change that I've seen during my 15 years in EU trade policy. And we're still on that path, and that's of course good. So in that sense, I would say that I think that EU trade policy, compared to when I started in the European Parliament 15 years ago, it's definitely being more offensive, and it's being better and serving the purpose of trade rather than being anything but trade, which was for a while seemed like almost the motto of EU trade policy. But at the same time, I think we see that the overregulation of different sectors in the European Union is creating problems for the European trade policy to deliver, and the reluctance to commit in trade agreements in different areas makes it more and more difficult, and makes the European Union more and more defensive. Take, for example, the digital services. The whole debate on GDPR in Europe has virtually destroyed the possibility for EU to do ambitious trade agreements with digital services. And it definitely destroyed the opportunity for the European Union to do a trade and services plurilateral, because we couldn't deliver what others could. And that was fundamentally due to the interpretation of the EU privacy legislation, GDPR. But it's not only that. We also have had a lot of really destructive debates that has limited the mandate and the room for maneuver of the Commission. Take, for example, investment. The European Union lacks an investment policy, global investment policy, and a strategy to do new bilateral investment treaties. And that was created in the aftermath of the free trade agreement with Canada and the very strange debate we had on investor-to-state dispute settlement. The fact is that we haven't really sorted that out by now, and as a consequence, we're not doing new good bilateral investment agreements. Japan, for example, lacks a bilateral investment agreement. And I can definitely see even more of those complexities and how EU internal debate and EU internal regulation limits our ability to act offensively in the area of trade policy.
One of the casualties from that debate on EU investment policy was TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which was due to be negotiated between the EU and the United States, but then came the big debate about investment treaties and investor-state dispute settlement in bilateral investment treaty. It led to difficulties to ratify the agreement with Canada. It imposed a delay in the negotiations with America, and that delay turned out to be longer than expected because there was a change in the administration of the United States. And after the entry of Donald Trump in the White House, there has been sort of a testy relation between European Union and America on trade policy. Now, however, they are due to start negotiations again, and I noticed that the European Parliament had a vote, a consultative vote, whether the European Commission should get the mandate to negotiate a trade agreement with the United States, but the Parliament couldn't give its assent because it couldn't find a majority for it. So, what do you think is going to happen in these negotiations with the United States? Can they deliver something? Will we have a Parliament that finally can agree?
That's a very relevant question, because that points towards the question, are we open for business in Europe right now? Do we have the political backing to do ambitious trade agreements right now? And again, clearly, we didn't have the ability to do an agreement with Japan that included digital services and investment protection. And I would definitely question whether the European Union is in a state right now to ratify an agreement with the US. On the other hand, I'm a big proponent of an agreement between the EU and the US, but I think one has to be rather realistic on whether that's actually the objective of this negotiation. Are we right now entering these negotiations due to the fact that we think there will be an ambitious agreement at the end, or is it rather a maneuver to try to keep lines open and keep constructive discussions and therefore stop eventual car tariffs, something that Donald Trump has threatened with? And I would say that the majority view in the European Parliament and in Brussels right now is rather that we have to keep lines open and avert any risk for car tariffs, rather than that there's a real mood for moving forward with the ambitious free trade agreement with the US. But with that said, it's sad and worrying that even though I think a majority of the members of the European Parliament that voted on a resolution on whether to start these negotiations knew, a majority of them knew that the main objective here was to avert trade conflict rather than to have an agreement, we still didn't manage to get a majority to actually agree a resolution on having a negotiation mandate. I would say right now signals that we might not be as really be ready for pushing forward the ambitious trade agenda that the Commission points at and the Commission claims that we're trying to do. So I would question that right now. The next mandate of the European elections that will take place in just a couple of weeks, that question is of course even more up for grab. Nobody can say how the next parliament will actually address trade policy. But right now, we have a worrying trend. Just let me add one example. Take the chairman of the International Trade Committee, a German Social Democrat, Bernd Lange, who I think is a member representing a car manufacturing district in Germany. And take the fact that he actually voted against giving mandate the consultative, even though consultative, but still giving the green light for negotiations with the US. And for me, that signals that not only the lack of sense of responsibility among German social democrats, but it also says something about the mood when it comes to trade policy in Brussels.
Would you say, Christopher, that the European Parliament itself has over time become less embracive of free trade or trade agreements?
When I started in the European Parliament, we didn't have any real power in the area of trade. But with the Lisbon Treaty, that changed. And I must admit that I was genuinely worried what would happen when the European Parliament got co-decision in the area of trade policy. I was afraid that we would have another Congress on the other side of the pond that more or less only obstructed and didn't contribute in any constructive way at all. But I must say that luckily, up until recently at least, the European Parliament has shouldered that responsibility and risen to the occasion and been able to take the important decisions, with a few exceptions. For example, the Anti-Counterfeit Trade Agreement, ACTA, that was killed off in the European Parliament. But what I worry about right now is the fact that the populism that is a problem not only in Europe, I think it's a global trend, will actually make the European Parliament more and more irresponsible in the area of trade. And that after this election, that it might be even tougher to keep a positive agenda in the area of trade.
And what would you say that a positive agenda would look like in, say, the next 5 years? We have on one hand a couple of tough issues confronting us. You mentioned, for instance, the negotiations we're going to have with the United States, and that one of the motivations behind those negotiations can actually be that we want to contain more protectionism against Europe from the United States administration. Donald Trump, for instance, have threatened to impose tariffs on automotives, as you talked about. In the World Trade Organization, where it's proven to be very difficult to appoint new judges to the dispute settlement body, and that the opposition to those appointments have largely come from the United States. So we have sort of an agenda which I wouldn't call it negative, but it is about containing different problems out there. But if we look at the positive agenda, negotiating new trade agreements with the rest of the world, where do you think we should go next? One of the arguments right now is, for instance, that, well, there aren't that many countries in the world to do free trade agreements with, because we have negotiated with quite many of them. And those that we could do free trade agreements with, well, there are a number of obstacles to them. For instance, we tried to start negotiations with India a few years ago. Those negotiations were basically buried in the freezer for a long time, and it has been proven difficult to reactivate them. So what would a positive, outward-oriented free trade agenda for Europe look like in the next 5 years?
I have a pretty clear wish list, actually. First of all, one has to acknowledge that all charity starts at home, and you can never be more offensive in the area of trade and create more liberalization through trade agreements than you have been able to foster at home. So there's a lot of work that we could do in the current environment to actually make it possible for the European Union to have a more of an offensive agenda and do better trade agreements in the future. To start with, I think that we have to actually get our head around digital services, because we can't be in a situation where the growing part of trade is something that we're not able to negotiate and do deals around, and that is of course the digital economy and data flows. And you could have other areas as well where the burden of European regulation virtually makes it impossible for us to do ambitious trade agreements. We have to do reforms of our phytosanitary rules and pesticides legislation and other things that actually makes it possible for us to do good trade agreements with countries like Brazil or Mercosur. So there's a lot of liberalization back home in a lot of areas that we should focus on in the coming 5 years. But aside of different sector-specific legislation enabling us to be more offensive trade policy, I think we also have to adapt. We can't build our trade policy on the basis of WTO. We do have a bilateral trade policy right now, and a bilateral trade policy means that we complicate trade a lot. Jagdish Bhagwati's famous example of the spaghetti bowl, where we now, through all these different bilateral trade agreements, have made it almost easier to pay the tariff than it is to actually adapt to all the different trading rules and rules of origin, is a relevant concern in Europe right now. Therefore, I think we have to do a totally new revision of our rules of origin legislation in Europe. When I meet traders, they say that with global supply chains, the current rules of origin that we practice in Europe today is just out of date and created for, at best, the WTO multilateral agenda, but it's by no means adopted for this bilateral agenda that we have. So internal reform in a lot of specific sectors, a real ambitious reform of the multilateral, of the rules of origin. And aside of that, I think that there's a lot of people in Brussels that are a little bit, that probably was a little bit relieved, how strange it might sound, to hear note that Donald Trump was elected president of the White House, because that meant that a lot of the criticism that could have been pointed at towards the European Union now ended up with the US instead. I think there could be a good plurilateral agenda out there for a lot of sector-specific agreements. Take, for example, the environmental goods agreements or the trade and services agreement. Two agreements that I think Europe has a profound responsibility for them not being done in time before the election of the new American president. And the reason that we that we one of the main reasons we didn't have those two plurilateral agreements is, of course, European protectionism when it comes to green goods in the area of bicycles, something China demanded, and in the area of the trade in services, the lack of a coherent position in data flows and digital services. I think that we should specifically go through what kind of plurilaterals would Europe want to have, and then we should see to that we do the necessary internal reform and restructuring of our tariffs to make it possible to negotiate ambitious outcomes in those plurilaterals. There are still also, I think, a number of important bilaterals that we should pursue, not at least Brazil and more Mercosur. Negotiators at least claimed that we were close to having an agreement before Christmas, but again, European protectionism in the area, of agriculture, and also, of course, South American protectionism in the area of industrial goods made that impossible. But if we start again with focusing on what we can deliver and try to look over our own policy when it comes to agriculture, so that we can actually conclude some of these agreements. Indonesia is another important trading partner that I think we should be able to do a good trade deal. But then we have to look over, for example, the regulation of renewable energy and our view on palm oil and things like that. So I think that there's a lot of things we could do to make it possible to drive a more offensive trade agenda in the very near future.
One final question, Christopher. So, going through the agenda that you just pointed us to, there could be a point of criticism, which is that you hardly mentioned China at all in that list. And a lot of people in Europe would say, well, look, we can talk us to death about different sort of free trade agreements that we want to do, but the main issue right now in global trade is going to be China. So the focus of those, and we're not talking about protectionists here, we're talking about people that are more, modest supporters of free trade or supporters of a reciprocitarian type of free trade. They would say that the focus now should be China. We need to have reciprocity in China. If they don't open their public procurement markets, well, then we're going to close our public procurement markets to them. And there is a more confrontational stance more generally coming towards China, also partly because of different sort of security issues that are coming up. So how would you look at that debate over China? What would be sort of a positive agenda for us doing something with China?
The reason why I laid out my hopes for future EU trade policy, the reason that I didn't point specifically on China is because I think that almost all the initiatives we do vis-à-vis China right now is more destructive rather than constructive. And the idea that we should use reciprocity, but in a negative way, we should start closing our markets to try to force somebody to open their markets. That's never been a recipe for success. I think for any of the main trading nations of the world. And we've never done that. And I think that there are a lot of those ideas, not at least in the area of public procurement, that's flying around right now. But that is something that I think will be fundamentally destructive, partly because I think it misses the point of public procurement specifically as such. Public procurement, the idea with having a European public procurement market that is open for the world, is not mainly a concession to the Chinese or anything like that. It is trying to get value for money for taxpayers. Because if we should limit what municipalities or governments in Europe would be able to source from, and not making them able to use the best deals on the market because of our offensive trade agenda, that is suboptimal in all ways. And I think that there is a real concern I have, and I think a lot of people have with China, but I think we should focus that on the right things. And that's for me, for example, security policy. I personally think that there are good arguments to be made on whether on why we should screen, for example, 5G investments by Chinese telecom. And there might be a good argument to be made around investment screenings and Chinese investments that might not be done out of commercial interest, but rather security policy or have other non-commercial interests driving them. But the best way to deal with those things is not by trying to link them to trade policy. I think they have to win on their own security policy merits rather than being dragged into a tit for tat trade agenda. And that's the biggest concern I have with a lot of these things. For example, I would have no problem with investment screening if it was an investment screening focusing on truly security concern. But a lot of people that now are pushing for investment screenings want to change that into some kind of protect national champions and the traditional protectionist agenda. And the minute we mix trade policy with security policy, then I think we will get lost and end up protectionist without us really wanting to.
Christopher, it's been a great pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you.